few weeks ago, I was speaking with Rafat. He's our new dev lead on Channel 9, and he was telling me about some of the interesting people that he talks to at Microsoft, and not just the projects that they're working on, but the interesting things about themselves. And so he said, someone should be telling their stories. And I said, well, you're in luck, Rafat, because we're Channel 9, and that's what we do here. So we gave him a camera, and he's going to go out and start talking to some of these folks. So this is the first one. This is with Jeffrey Snover. He was the architect on Windows Server, an inventor of PowerShell, and also a Microsoft Technical Fellow.
So welcome, Jeffrey, and thank you for doing this.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I want to start this interview with one of the incidents I want to share with the audience and with you. I don't know if you will remember. My first meeting with you, that was about 3 years back. I was new in server. I was, I think, 2 weeks old in server, and there was some design issue. And I went to my manager, Alan Back, and he said, go talk to Jeffrey. And I went to you. At that time, you were a distinguished engineer. And I was a little nervous, you know, going talking about server with someone who has done server for so long. And I was 2 weeks old. And the first thing you did, once you come to know that I am so new in the company, you said, F that title and tell me if I'm wrong. And I want to hear that I'm wrong. And the value you will bring in this company is challenging us, challenging our thought. So I guess that was very, very nice of you. Made me ease in the server group.
Yeah, it's one of the challenges senior people have. You know, I always try and go out of my way to tell people, hey, just, you know, it doesn't help. Doesn't help anybody to ship the wrong thing. So let's challenge the thinking. Don't, you know, ignore the title. Let's just figure out. But still, people don't do it. And so, you know, you got to create an environment where people know that it's okay to challenge authority. Because again, nope, you know, it doesn't help me. Oh, I won.
Right.
And then we ship the wrong thing. Like, I like to say, I've got a motto. I love mottos or aphorisms. One of my favorite aphorisms is, my job is not to come up with the best idea. My job is to ship the best idea.
Perfect.
There's a world of difference between those two.
Big thing, yes, big thing. And I think that sums up the Microsoft philosophy as such, right?
Absolutely.
Cool. So I will go back and start from the very beginning. Tell me, where did you grow up? Where did you went for school?
Ah, okay. Well, let's see. So actually, I was born right here. Right here in Seattle. But then I left before, we left before I was a year old. So my dad worked for defense contractors. And so we sort of moved all over. We were in Florida and I think Texas and New Jersey, but then mostly grew up in Massachusetts. And then after Massachusetts, I went to New Hampshire and Colorado. Well, it was a while in Mississippi. That was interesting.
Cool. So were you a good student when you were in school?
You know, mixed. You know, so I was a pretty smart guy, loved homework. I remember just being absolutely devastatingly disappointed when I went to first grade and there was no homework. And there was recess. It's like, what the heck's that crap?
Wow.
You know, let's study, let's learn. And so, you know, I was really into learning. But then I'd say that often I've have, if like if I was growing up today, I think I would be diagnosed with ADD. So, you know, I would get, you know, my attention would wander. And so it was mixed. You know, I got pretty good grades, but then occasionally I would just drift off.
So what was your aspiration when you were growing up and when you were in school? Are you from the generation of the rocket boys? Like you wanted to be astronaut or something?
No, no, but always science. You know, I love science. But no, I never wanted to be an astronaut.
Okay. Anybody who influenced you in your childhood?
Well, yeah, so as a childhood, sort of my heroes were, of course, Bruce Lee.
Who
I just thought the world of.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And his grave is here in Seattle.
Have you been there?
Two things I did after landing in Seattle. First is go see the Bruce Lee grave, and second, come to Microsoft.
Wow.
And to get two of those. Yes.
Isn't it beautiful?
It is. It is amazing.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's a work of art.
Right.
Anyway, so he was just such a presence. You know, I just thought the world of him, both a fantastic athlete and an actor, but then also a philosopher. So, yeah, he was deeply influential.
Yeah.
And then, of course, science, Isaac Asimov, I read all of his stuff. Not his science fiction, fiction, what the heck's that stuff? So all of his, but all of his science stuff, and he wrote a lot of science books.
Oh, cool, cool. So are you married?
Yep.
Tell me something about your family.
Yeah, let's see. So I guess we were married in 89, so whatever that is, a long time now. I got two kids, Brandon, who's 20, and Carrie, who's 18, sorry, going on 16.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So how do your kids see you, or how your kid will describe you? Because you're not a technical fellow in home.
Yeah, let's see, how would they describe me? I probably as a jokester. Mm. I joke around a lot, give them a hard time,
okay.
Tease them.
Are they into computers too?
No. You know, my boy does computer gaming, but not programming.
Okay.
And my daughter's starting to do that, but is not, it hasn't kicked in. The passion's not there for computers.
Mm.
My daughter's into horseback riding. She really likes that.
Oh, but. Cool. I don't know how long you've been in Microsoft. When did you join here first?
So let's see. Next month, it's going to be 17 years.
Wow, 17 years.
Yeah.
So did you work in other groups also, or you came in server?
So the joke is that, I never really wanted to join Microsoft. In fact, they called me up, and I was like, no, I don't want to work for Microsoft.
Huh.
But someone I had met before, a guy named Dave Thompson, mm-hmm. who I just thought the world of, he had the position. And so he reached out to me and said, well, Jeffrey, I'd like to talk to you. And I thought, well, I don't want to talk to Microsoft, but I like talking to Dave. And so the joke was that I never joined Microsoft, I joined Dave. Now, here's the thing. I fax in my letter of acceptance, fax back then, and 20 minutes after I faxed it in, I get a call from Dave. I think he's here to congratulate me. Hey, we got the fax, so pleased. I thought 20 minutes, wow, that's pretty good that you found out about that.
Right.
But no, he's calling me up to say, hey, there's been a reorganization.
Wow.
So he owns server, and he said, we decided to split out the management team, and so you're going to be the lead architect over a new management organization and not work for server. Anyway, so since then, the server and the management team have come together and split apart and come together and split apart. Yeah. So no, I've never moved anywhere, but...
but with the server.
Yeah, exactly.
So... before you were in Microsoft, I don't know which company you were, but what I'm interested in, after college, people do a lot of jobs. You have done any odd job, or you had a job there which is very interesting than,
Well, first,
other than norm?
I never got out of college, right?
Oh,
I dropped out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, dropped out. I kept running out of money.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so basically, I worked since a very early age, paper routes, and then bus boy, and had a job as a cleaner of guinea pig cages. Mm. I can recommend against that.
Right,
not a great job. When I went to school, I run out of money, and so I have to leave and go get a job, and then go back.
Wow.
Run out of money, go get a job. And so I had all sorts of jobs during college. I worked at Raytheon, where we did design of missiles, mm-hmm. Bombs and seekers for the missiles.
Wow.
And then when I was at school, I worked as a short order cook. Now, this is funny. So at some point, it was a short order cook, pizzas, hamburgers, that sort of stuff. And so at some point, the boss comes over and he says, hey, what are you studying again? I said, physics. He says, oh, are you any good at it? I said, well, yeah, actually, I'm pretty good. He says, that's good. You're not going to make it as a short order cook. So anyway, one of those jobs, then at some point I decided, boy, what am I spending my life making bombs? That doesn't seem like a constructive use of my life force. And so I moved out to Colorado to visit a buddy for a summer and got a job at Storage Technology. And there I was working as a quality engineer in a manufacturing environment, and they decided to computerize the shop floor. And then it was a complete disaster. And through a series of odd series of things, I sort of got put in charge of the project.
Right.
And I just fell in love with computers and what you could do with them, and that set the hook.
Wow.
And so then I stopped working and going back to college. I just worked.
Wow. So we never knew this, right? And I think it's, again, an inspiring story that college dropout to be a technical fellow in Microsoft.
In fact, I'm the highest ranked college dropout now that Bill's gone at Microsoft.
Yeah, so yeah. So even if there's no college, there's a hope for everybody else. So I'll change the question a little bit.
Sure.
What are the top three things you value most to keep yourself happy? Like when you have 15 things to be done, and you're very busy, and so many projects going on, what are the top three things you keep in your mind that, you know, these are the P0, P1, P2?
Oh, this is at work?
At work or in personal life.
Oh, well, let's do at work. So, again, sort of this ADD mind, right? Somebody asked me, well, what's a typical day like? I don't have a typical day. My day is full of interruptions, and I'm always trying to find the thing where I can move the needle the most. So for me, so in college, you know, studied physics and also philosophy. And in philosophy, studied philosophy of science and then existentialism, and decided that I was an existentialist. Mm. An existentialist basically believes that when you die, there's nothing else, right? And that this is it, and you have to decide what it is you want to do with your time and what meaning means for you, what has meaning. So for me, I decided that impact, you know, that having an impact on the world was what mattered to me. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the reasons why I came to Microsoft, right? So, hey, I was a really big player in a company called Tivoli, right? Mm-hmm. Do your friends run Tivoli?
No.
Your friends run Tivoli? Right, no, right? So what was the impact? You know, I had this big position and very influential on something nobody had ever heard of.
Right.
And so then at Microsoft, you have the opportunity to have big impact, right?
Right.
We're coming up on a $100 billion company, over a billion customers, and when you have an idea, you have an opportunity to change the world. And so that's always sort of what the number one thing I'm looking to do is opportunity to have an impact and make the world different because I existed, hopefully in a better way, in a good way. And then the second is expand my knowledge. Those are the two things I mostly focus in. Oh, sorry, and the third is, you know, have impact by helping other people succeed. Mm. You know, one of the great things about my job is, I like to joke, I said, we were just doing some prep for a presentation, and I said, oh, well, you know, we're going to do this together, so put your name there, and we'll put it first. And she said, oh, are you okay? I said, look, I can never be promoted.
That's so true.
Yeah, I can't be promoted
anymore. Yeah.
Anymore. So, you know, I don't need any kudos. I don't need any ego. I don't need any, like, hey, that's mine. And so I have the luxury, and it's really a joy to being able to spend a bunch of my time helping other people succeed, highlighting their contributions. And that's a really fun place to be. You know, I sort of always had that. And then, but there was always at the end, though, I still have to, you know, have something I can put associated with my name, too. Good. And now, you know, basically I have to not get fired, you know, but it is not like a...
Wow. So as they say, you reach to that self-actualization stage of yours.
I don't know about self-actualization, but it's pretty good. I'm up there on Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Okay. Yeah, that's so true. One thing I always wondered about in Microsoft, so many things are happening and so many things changing around us. And you are in the middle of all that. And you are carrying the burden of server, which is like 10, 20 years backward compatibility.
Sure.
Everything has to be there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How you keep up with all this?
Well, you can't. That's the answer. Mm-hmm. I was just having this conversation like an hour ago where somebody was telling me about some internal machine learning conference. I was like, oh, that's cool. He says, oh, yeah, well, we've had six of them. I said, six of them? So, well, okay, so how many people show up to this thing? So a couple thousand people. So it's this massive thing that I was completely oblivious to. And the point is that at Microsoft, what, we spend, I think it's $12 billion a year, $12 billion a year on research and development.
Right.
And guess what? When you spend that much money, there's so many things going on, it's impossible to keep up to date.
Right.
And so it's a real challenge to figure out how to pick your battles. Anybody who rises to a certain level of responsibility realizes that they can't be an expert in their full domain. Mm-hmm. And so what they have to do is they basically have to figure out strategies to deal with that. And everybody has a different way. Some people then rely on experts. Some people rely on management techniques. Some people decide, hey, they're uncomfortable with that and decide to take a lower level of responsibility. So it's always a challenge.
It is.
So what I do is I have breadth responsibilities, and they're massive. Mm-hmm. And then I've got a few depth responsibilities. Because, you know, if you stay at this breadth stuff, the problem there is that actually Anders Hausberg, he said it the best. At some point, somebody asked him, Anders, do you still write code? And he said, of course I still write code. Architects that don't write code are architects that believe anything is possible. Okay?
Right.
So if you're not grounded in reality in at least some level, then what you find, and I definitely find myself drawn to this, is like, hey, I put it on a PowerPoint, it must be real. And then, well, hey, wait a second, it's been a couple months now. Why isn't that done, you know?
Right.
And so you have to be grounded in reality. So you want to always have some depth responsibilities where maybe you're not even, you're not checking in the code, but you're writing the code, you're realizing what it takes to get a job done, so you're always grounded.
Right, right. So I think you can advise somebody who is 59 or 60, just joining Microsoft.
Level 59 or 60.
As a dev.
Yeah, they don't know levels. That's a junior level.
Junior level of dev who just joined Microsoft. What advice you can give him to reach to these heights?
Oh, well, let's see. So I'd say the most important thing is that, you know, do great at the level you are, right? Mm-hmm. Each level has a set of lessons to learn, and you can't get to the next level without learning and mastering the lessons of a level. I mean, there are certain people who you look at them and you say, hey, this person, if they were vice president, would be an awesome vice president.
Right.
But they're not a vice president, and we're managing out of the company because they can't be successful at the level they are.
True.
I'm not going to make them a vice president because you got to go through the ranks. And so each level has a set of lessons, right? Junior levels, you need to figure out how to set and meet expectations. You need to know when to ask for help. Mm-hmm. Critical thing. A lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to, I'll just keep it all, and then they fail. No, learn how to ask for help. Then you need to be able to write reliable, consistent, you know, consistently reliable code on a predictable schedule that endures. And then from there, you got to learn design skills. Then you got to learn good design skills and durable design skills and how to write things for ecosystems, plugins, how to write it robust when somebody comes in with bad code and stuff like that, all those sorts of lessons. Then at some point you need to shift and you need to learn, well, hey, to be successful, it's not just about me and my keyboard producing code. I need to influence other people. And so how do you communicate to other people? How do you influence? How do you make decisions? At the end of the day, one person said it really well. He said, you know, engineers can't destroy a company, but program managers can. And that is to say, what's most important is not so much the individual piece of code. I mean, nothing goes on without that. But if it's the wrong code, if it's implementing the wrong set of functions, that's no good either. So there's this judgment about how do you decide where to go, where to take the code?
Right.
How do you listen to customers? How do you figure out how to respond to their needs? And then how do you do so? Like, okay, customers want here. Okay, that's 5-10 years away.
Right.
How do you get from here to there? What? How do you break down that work? And then how do you figure out, well, okay, that's what I want, but here's the capabilities I have. Here's the number of resources I've been given. Here's the skill set of those people. It's a rich set of tasks.
That's true, that's true.
And then I always tell, here's the trick one though. People always ask, you know, the thing about a technical fellow is that the heart of the technical fellow is this individual contributor. We have technical fellows with, you know, 700 people working for them, but really, you know, the heart of it is these individual technical contributors, and that's what people like. And they ask, well, how do you become one of those senior people? Now, here's one of the ironies. I always tell them, at some point, you have to be a manager. Mm-hmm. Like, but that's specifically what I don't want to do. And I say, they totally understand, but to succeed at the senior levels, you have to be a manager at some point. And the reason for this, for that is this. The senior individual contributors always partner with an executive to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to be a great partner of that person. You have to have empathy for that job. And the reality is the job of a manager is a really hard, really horrible job, right?
It's like, a tough job.
It's a very tough job, right? Yeah. Oh, hey, here's this budget. Here's this curves. Like, hey, I've got a group of, they're all fantastic people. Right. Well, here's a curve. You got to give some people lows and some people high. It's like, but that doesn't make any sense. And if you've never had the job, you'd say, well, let's just go explain to people that we have the best people in the company and we, that curve doesn't right. apply to us.
Right.
And the answer as a manager is like, you don't have that flexibility. Shut up. You're making my life miserable.
True.
And there's all sorts of things about that management job, things that they are empowered to do, and therefore you need to know when to push them outside of their comfort zone to get them to do things that they're a little uncomfortable
right.
doing. And then those things where they're just not, it's just not possible to do.
Right.
And you're not helpful in pushing for that.
True.
Right? You hurt the partnership.
Right.
And so anyway, so you got to be a partner, or sorry, be a manager at some point to learn those lessons and then
right.
put it behind you.
Because I think being manager is you are beyond code also.
Yeah.
Right? Because you are dealing with humans and manager it's a job of a person who is doing all 360 everything.
Yeah.
It's no more one responsibility that you just write a good code and you're done with it.
Well, you put your finger right on it.
Right.
The thing that effective people understand is that at the end of the day, this business is all about humans.
Yes.
It's all about humans. You know, we like to think code and design, blah, blah, blah. No,
right.
no, no. The, behind all that is a human who shows up to work.
Right.
They show up enthusiastic or not enthusiastic.
Right.
You know, I like to say that projects succeed or fail in half-hour increments, right?
True.
So, hey, it's half an hour before they were planning to go home and something goes wrong, right?
Right.
What do they do, right? Do
yes.
they spend the time and the extra half an hour so to get it successful so that they get that code checked in so that then it gets integrated and billed and the other people can use it the next day?
True.
Or do they say, nah, I'm going to go home. I'll pick it up tomorrow.
Right.
And they pick it up tomorrow. They come in. They're interrupted. They don't get to it for an hour and a half. Then they do it. It takes longer than a half an hour because they lost their train of thought.
Right.
And then people aren't able to use it for a while.
True. It's all, you know, very perfect, you know, very good advice for anybody in Microsoft. But I'm just wondering, for all this experience,
yep.
I have to go through this journey, and obviously there's no shortcut in life.
No.
But reading can be, you know, scaling your learning
quickly. Absolutely.
So I'm wondering, can you suggest any non-technical books which people should read?
Oh, sure. So I had the benefit of like having worked on a lot of failed projects, right? And so let us say they were great projects, you know, worked my butt off, technology was fantastic, et cetera, but then they went off nowhere, right? And so I decided, well, the problem is, you know, I've got bad marketing. And so, you know what? I went and studied marketing. And
wow.
And that was very helpful. And again, this thing about good technical people know how to build the right products versus a product. Learning about marketing was one of the most useful things I ever did. So for me, the thing I loved there was Michael Porter. Michael
mm-hmm.
Porter has a couple books, Competitive Advantage, I think Strategic Advantage or Competitive Strategy, but Michael Porter out of Harvard
and
has a great way to think about how to build products. Jeffrey Moore, of course, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a look at the Monad Manifesto,
right.
Section 10 is all these Jeffrey Moore value proposition things.
Oh, okay.
And that's about for this market, who, differentiator, product, value proposition. Unlike competitor, product, and then your differentiators.
Right.
And it sounds very simple, but
right.
you try and do it and you realize it's extraordinarily hard. But when you get through the other end, then you are clear about what you're building, why you're building it, and what's important. Like, you know, you make 1,000 decisions, and when to say, hey, that's fine, and when to say, no, we
right.
must do this.
Right.
And then lastly, the one that I do a lot of mentoring, and the book I recommend the most, and I think the book most people get the most benefit out of, is a book called Persuasion, the Psychology of Persuasion, I think. No,
okay.
Influence. The book's called Influence,
okay.
the Psychology of Persuasion.
Wow.
And just a fantastic book.
Right. So who would have thought that to be successful in tech, you have to know marketing, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you're so spot on because I'm exactly in that spot here. I'm in a marketing group and I was looking around and I'm seeing, oh my God, that skill which you need to be a good, you know, marketer is a lifelong thing. And it's the most important skill you can have. To know about how to market an idea, how to market a product or how to market even yourself.
Yeah, or how to define the right product.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's okay. Thank you very much. I think this
Well, you know, I had a great, again, I had a lot of great experiences growing up. So it was that storage technology. I remember meeting with this executive, that project I talked about, and at some point we're having lunch and he says, well, you have no idea what we do here. I said, well, I think we do. He said, no, you don't, because I was talking about great engineering. We'll do this fantastic engineering. He's like, you have no clue what this is all about. And I was like, well, I think I do. He says, no. He says, here's the thing you got to understand. He says, cows are just a farmer's way of turning grass into cash. I said, what in the world are you talking about? He says, think about it. He says, this is important to understand. What's a farmer have? He's got a bunch of grass. Well, guess what? Nobody wants grass. Right? So how does he get, what he wants is cash. So how does he turn grass into cash? And so what he does is he gets cows. Cows eat the grass, they get larger, people want cows. So he turns, cows are just the way of turning grass into cash. He says, so here we are, we're building disk drives. So what do we have? We got buildings and we've got smart guys like you. And what are we doing? We're using these things to produce disk drives, to produce cash. It's all about meeting a customer's need and getting business benefit
business
from it, cash.
Right.
And that was one of those like, oh, I get it.
Right.
So at some point you gotta know what's going on so
right.
that you can make the right set of decisions. Because I was making all these decisions about, oh, the great engineering. He said, no, just be effective.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing I always wondered about you especially, about the collaboration, mm-hmm. how you influence other teams. So when I have to partner with my sister team, I don't find it to be very easy, right?
Uh-huh.
Because they have their own charter, their own goals, and then suddenly I'm there with my need. So I always wondered how you turn around this big ship, Microsoft, and you put the PowerShell across all these groups. So two things, like how you influence these people with big personalities, right?
Uh-huh.
All the VPs of this product here in Microsoft. And how you resolve conflict?
Yeah, real hard questions. So first I'd say that, you know, being right has a lot of value. And say, when physics is on your side, things go well. You know, physics and time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality is that I think things were tougher for me when the company wasn't so much listening to what customers wanted. And as we year by year started listening to the customers, things became easier. So basically, but that's because I was right. Now,
right.
Now we moved the ball forward a lot sooner than that. And the answer is, first I'd say it's a mixed success. You know, people always look at the end and say, oh, you were successful. They don't see the years that you weren't successful. But I'd say that you want to have empathy and you want to understand the other person. You know, and often what you want to do is there's a phrase I use, speaking into someone's listening, right?
Mm.
So you got to understand when you talk to someone, what is their world? What are the things they care about? What are the things that are important to them? And then figure out how to speak to that so that they hear the thing you're trying to communicate. So exactly the same message, I will say it differently whether I'm talking to someone in marketing versus someone in sales versus someone in support versus an engineering manager versus an engineering directive versus Bill Gates.
Right.
You know, you just like, okay, so what does Bill care about? He doesn't care about these things. He's got to hear this. So you speak to that.
So you have to tailor the message according to the person you're speaking.
And, yeah.
And that's one way. The conflicts may not even arise because you thought about it beforehand.
They might still arise, but then you know what's going on. And often,
right.
You know, what the heck? We just recently had one of these where it came in and like, oh, okay, so somebody said, oh, we have this big conflict with this other team. And, you know, can you go force them to do the right thing? I said, well, I'll go talk to the guy. And so I said, hey, you know, tell me about what's going on, what's the issues and such, because here's sort of what we're trying to accomplish. And what I find is, it's always important to discuss what you're trying to accomplish and what your interests are versus what your position is, right? Because then what you do is you approach it as joint problem solving. Like,
right.
Hey, I have these problems. Can we work together to figure out how to solve them? Because I know you have some problems there and what's going to work for you. If you come in and say, it has to be X, well, maybe that doesn't work for that other person. But if
right.
you're open to joint problem solving, maybe come up with a different solution. Anyway, so after having talked to this person 15 minutes, it's like, oh, now I totally understand why there's this problem. That makes absolute sense. So here are the three things, correct me wrong, buddy, here are the three things I think are absolutely critical for you. You know, security and control and this. And so right now, when we come to you and we say this, these things aren't working. He says, no, that's exactly it. I said, okay, great, thanks. So we'll go address those issues and then we'll come back.
Right, okay.
So you got, yeah.
So you basically become the partner with them.
Yeah, you know, again, I worked at Apollo and we got a great executive there who said, you have to take responsibility. Whenever we do a deal, we must take responsibility for everyone being successful in that deal, right? Mm-hmm. That it's a good deal for everyone. Because you might be sitting in a business deal where you're like, oh, we're going to do great and this person's going to get screwed. He says, I want you to turn down that business. He says, that's bad business. If that person doesn't walk away, you know, thinking this is a great deal and a year later think it's a great deal, it's not going to be a good deal for us.
Wow.
And you have to take, you have to take responsibility to ensure that that other person's going to be successful.
Right.
It's like, wow. What a great,
yeah, what a great concept. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was right, because, you know, we once had a deal where, you know, I think we did that, but the other person felt like it wasn't a good deal for them,
right.
And then it was just pure misery.
Right, right. So the, you know, whole world knows about a lot of your accomplishment, things where you were successful. Tell me where you're about your biggest failure.
Oh, biggest failure. Wow. Well, as short order cook, pretty much failed at that job. Maybe that wasn't my biggest one. I don't know. I think the one I'd say that, kind of hard to, you know, how you categorize a
True.
Failure. But I would say that one of the things that bothers me the most is not having ever gotten that degree. You know, and I'll say that it's a good and a bad thing not having gotten the degree. So first, I'm embarrassed by it, but then I walk into work every day like insecure.
Mm.
You know, all these other people, PhD here, PhD,
right.
The doctor this and all that. And I don't have one of those. And so I always feel, you know, one down because of that.
Sense.
But another token, I think it's a good thing because I always feel like I got to come today and just prove it. You know, just
right.
Be better than other people, just work harder, be writer, and also not to sort of be a jerk.
True.
You know, I think somebody said, I think there's a significant element of luck in getting to the high levels,
True.
Right?
True.
Which is, say, luck and timing. You know, there's a lot of people, you have to be a certain level.
Right.
And then at some point, you know, sometimes the books are closed. Like, I think I made this technical fellow last year. Honestly, I felt I should have been that a couple years before. But the answer was the books were closed,
True.
Right? So there's True. Books aren't open.
Right.
And so, you know, there's timing. And then when the books open, it's like, okay, but we're looking for this. So
yes.
At some point they said, oh, well, hey, I said, well, what does it take to become technical fellow? It's like, well, you know, you need to have much broader scope than you have now.
Mm.
So you need to, you know, and so I said, okay, great. So what about this job? And they said, yeah, that's exactly the sort of thing. Lead architect for the,
right.
And I said, okay, great. And so it took me a while to get good at that job,
right.
I think. And then I felt I did good, and then I felt I did really good. So I thought,
right.
Well, hey, knock on that door again. I said, well, you know, now what do you think? And they're like, well, no. I said, oh, no, what? Okay, why, what's up? They said, well, you know, you're too broad. You know, we're focus. It's like, well, wait a second. And
yeah.
The answer was that the criteria had shifted. There's no sense complaining. That's what happens. Things
True.
Shift. And so there is a certain amount of luck in these things and timing.
Right.
Now, some people don't believe that.
Right.
But my observation is that the people who don't believe that often aren't the nicest people.
Right.
And
right.
So whenever I deal with people, I try and be pretty humble and pretty nice.
Right.
And it's because I think there's a lot of luck in my success.
True, true. And I think with the, you know, online learning, so many options people have about learning now, not like before, only college is the only place where you can go and learn anything. Today, MIT, Stanford, they all have online, almost free courses everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I think degrees are losing their value because you are more concerned about who knows the thing. And
well,
often you find a person who don't have a degree and knows it.
when I was coming into the industry, you know, we had people, engineers, from a very wide range of backgrounds, right?
Right.
You know, liberal artists, philosophy majors. In fact, one of the great guys in the C++ community, Jim Waldo, had a PhD in philosophy. My wife worked with this awesome engineer, and he was a trucker.
Wow.
Like, he was a trucker, and he'd occasionally, when he'd come back to, they having troubles with their computer system, he said, well, let me take a look at it. And he started writing all this code, and then he became a programmer, and then he became this senior consulting engineer at Digital. It's like, oh, how'd you, what degree do you have? I don't have a degree. Well, what'd you do? I was a trucker.
True.
So, yeah.
And especially I see here in Microsoft, at the end of the year when we do the review and all, I don't think I ever paid attention that which college this guy is coming from.
Yeah, right.
You are
all
always
effective.
Concerned about what he has done, what he knows. Yeah. So I seen
and
that,
how he did it.
And how he did it.
Or she
exactly.
did it.
And I see, you know, people who are college dropout sometimes better than Ivy League colleges. So it's all about how you do it and what you do. Right? Confucius said, I think, every human has two lives.
Uh-huh.
And your second life starts when you realize you have only one life.
Ah, okay.
So when was that moment came in your life?
Well, that actually came pretty early on. So again, when I was studying college, so basically here was the model. Total science geek. Science, and not just like, oh, I like science. But for me, science was truth. Right? And physics was like the purest of truths, right? There's physics and everything else was stamp collecting. I mean, I just believed in everything being the foundation of truth. And then at some point, like, oh, I got to take some liberal arts courses or I don't get to, you know. And so I just started taking philosophy. And I thought, well, I'll take philosophy of science. That'll be good.
Right.
And I started to get into epistemology and ontology and understand, and then quantum physics was kicking in at that point. And realize that, oh, well, actually, it's not really true. It's just a useful model. And that was very difficult for me. You know, that was sort of like the dog standing on a mirror looking down, right? Like,
yes.
What the heck? And so then I got into philosophy and really studied it. And in the end, I became an existentialist that basically believes that, you know, at the end of your life, there is nothing and you have to decide. So that was a very difficult period. But again, that started in my college years.
College years, okay.
Yeah.
So I have a last question from your grave. If God gives you one chance
okay.
to do your last tweet, what will be your last tweet?
Okay, well, being an existentialist, if God gave me a chance to tweet from the grave, I'd say, oops, I was wrong.
Cool. So with that, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
And hopefully I'll see you guys again in the next episode. Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you very much for doing this. Thank you for watching the show. We'll be back with another interesting personality of Microsoft.